Tonight, I'm going to begin the first of a number of sessions where we're going to talk about the church. This is the last session where I'm going to embed that in a much larger and, I think, more important story. And so from here on out, I'm going to be talking more about the church, less about the context. But I haven't been talking at all about the church the first two sessions, and I'm going to talk mainly about the church toward the end of this session. If you remember in our interrupted series, the last time we were together, I had told you about the birth of Baptists as a part of the separatist movement of people who were trying to purify and withdraw from the Anglican Church for a variety of reasons. They didn't believe it was spiritual enough. They didn't believe it was evangelical enough. They didn't believe it was fair in terms of its treatment of people who were dissenters. And so for a variety of reasons, people left, joined what were called separatist churches, and one of these separatist churches split, and part of the separatist church winds up being the Pilgrims, who established the New England colonies, and the other half become Baptist, and they move back to England, and then they filter into the American colonies later. Tonight I want to pick the story up with that filtering into the American colonies. Because in the interval between the last session and this session, England has established colonies. It has fought colonial wars against the Indians and the French and the Spanish, and it's taken land. And they have now established the 13 colonies. And I want to treat you to a little bit of American history here that is very important to this story. Because historians have argued for many, many decades about whether most Europeans who came to America came for reasons of persecution, religious persecution being the most important example of that, but political persecution and other kinds of persecution as well, or whether most of the settlers came because of economic reasons. And the conclusion is pretty much that most settlers who came here came mainly for economic opportunity, because they did not like their status in Europe. Fewer of them came for religious reasons, but the truth of the matter is, a lot of historians argue that it's kind of hard to figure that out because many people came for both reasons. They came for religious freedom, and they came because people who were denied religious freedom tended to also be at the bottom of the economic socio ladder in England especially, but in other countries as well. So now the argument is pretty much that why argue about that? Because it was both and, not either or. And as a result of that, when people came to America, they were religious in the way in which they had been religious in Europe. So if you'd been a Baptist in Europe, you were a Baptist here. If you'd have been a separatist there, you were a separatist here, although they increasingly call themselves Puritan and then Congregationalist. If you were a Quaker there, you were a Quaker here. If you were a Lutheran there, you were a Lutheran here. And so it went. And as a consequence of that, many of the people who were Quakers, Baptists, or something else in England and had been persecuted came here, and what they sought here was to be left alone and to be able to exercise their religious faith in whatever the way they wanted. However, those who came for other reasons, like, for instance, economic reasons, did not consider the transition from Europe to the colonies to be a statement about religious freedom at all. And therefore, they tried to impose what they knew in Europe on the colonists here in America. And so if you were from England and you were an Anglican, the first thing you thought was that in a civilized society, everybody ought to be willing to pay a tithe to the Anglican Church because that's important to civilized order and morality and worship of God. And therefore, this is what we knew in England. This is what we do here. Furthermore, there were some people who had been separatist in England, but when they got to New England, decided that although it was not right to impose Anglicanism on people who were not Anglicans, it was perfectly fine to impose Puritanism on people who were not Puritans. Now, this should not surprise you, and in fact, most of you should say, well, they're just human, aren't they? Which is what you demand for yourself in a society in which you're the minority. you then try to impose on others when you're the majority. Think Southern Baptist in the South, if you want a good example of a people who once upon a time were a persecuted minority in the South, but once they got to be the majority, they pretty much demanded that everybody conform to the Southern Baptist ways of doing things. If you don't believe that, try to get a drink of alcohol in a number of counties in Mississippi and Alabama, and you'll find out how Southern Baptists impose their own moral values upon the minority when they are not the minority, but the majority. Now, all of this is played out in 13 colonies where religion is really important in the most elemental way. That is, what answer can you give to the eternal questions about what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? What is my fate? And the answer to those questions were, however you define yourself denominationally, essentially religious answers. And I'll talk more about the reason for that later on. As a matter of fact, if you look at the books published in America, and there were lots published in Philadelphia, New York, Charleston, all over the urban 13 colonies, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books were published between Jamestown in early 1600s and Plymouth Colony and 1700. And of those books, one half, 50%, were about religion. To answer the question about why am I here, what is life all about, what is my fate, Calvinism versus Arminianism, theological arguments, doctrinal arguments, arguments, infant baptism, every kind of art. And some of these, you think I write big books. I wish you could see. You could actually give up your upper body weights and just carry these books around. Speaking of which, I asked the University of Alabama Press if they would consider making a special price for the Alabama Baptist book because I talk so much about Auburn First Baptist Church and the context. And they were willing to ship me a bunch of boxes of books for $5 a piece. And these normally sell for $30. So if you want my History of Alabama Baptist to follow this story along, you can get it for $5 as long as they last. Okay, so people are religious in the sense they think about religion, they talk about religion, they argue about religion, they join churches. But on the eve of the American Revolution in 1775, only 10% of people who lived in America were members of churches. And so I'm sure you're all thinking that, number one, I have been told a terrible lie all my life because I've been told that never was America more religious than at the beginning. Not so, if by religious you mean institutionally affiliated with the church. If you believe, if you mean believe in God, probably so. But if you mean by being religious that you were a member of a church, you were baptized, you went to church, you listened to preachers, not so. And as a matter of fact, every religious census since the first American census has indicated that more Americans were in church than were in church in 1775 when this country began. Furthermore, one reason why fewer books were published about religion between 1700 and 1800 is that Americans had other things on their mind. What do you think they really had on their minds in the years that are the run-up to 1776? Not really. Revolution. More and more, even religious books are like Jonathan Mayhew's great treatise in 1754 called Unlimited Submission to Sovereign Powers, in which he makes the argument that when you read in the Bible where God said, obey the government, he didn't mean the British government. He certainly didn't have that in mind. And so Jonathan Mayhew was saying, you have a right to revolution when the king, who is supposed to be ruling in the name of God, does in fact violate the ordinances of God as he has in governing the 13 colonies. So we are becoming more and more political. We are obsessed with politics. We are obsessed with John Locke and Montesquieu and the Enlightenment, and we're thinking less and less about God and less about doctrine. The reason that is really important is because when the American Revolution begins, most of you would not want to be living in the American colonies, nor would you want to be religious people in those colonies. For instance, in Connecticut, you would not have been able to vote because you would not have been eligible by church membership. In Maryland, my Rodham ancestors arrived there after losing the War of the Roses. They were Lancastrians and they were Catholics. And when they lost their land in Yorkshire, the founder of the Rodham family in America moved to Maryland because it had been founded by a Catholic in order to assure Catholics who were now a religious persecuted minority in England, religious freedom in America. On the eve of the American Revolution, if you were Catholic and lived in Maryland, you were not allowed to hold public office, despite the fact Maryland had been founded by a Catholic. Now, how weird is that? In 9 of the 13 colonies, you had to pay taxes to support the state church, even if you were a Baptist, and there was no Baptist colony that established a state church. And in fact, the only colony in America in 1776 where a majority of the population belonged to the church that was getting the money was in Virginia, where a narrow majority belonged to the Anglican church. In every other state, the majority of the people did not belong to the church, which was being supported by their tax money, even if it was doctrine that they did not believe. So you can understand that insofar as religion is a central focus of America in the early years of our history, none of you would feel very comfortable in that world. Furthermore, after the American Revolution ended, in New Jersey, North Carolina, and South Carolina, the only people who were allowed to hold office were Christians. In Delaware, in order to vote, you had to affirm your belief in the Trinity. And this is well into the period after the American Constitution. And in fact, as all of you in this room know, there were certain groups of people who were disqualified from being president of the United States, not officially by documents, but unofficially by practice, until John Kennedy was elected in 1960 as a Catholic. And some would even argue Southern evangelicals who claimed they were born again until Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976. And I would argue that even to this day, a Mormon or a Muslim, the two M groups, would have a hard time winning the presidency of the United States. So what we see in the early American colonies and what we see in the early American Republic is to some degree still true now. You are not officially disqualified in the way you were then, but you can be unofficially disqualified in the way you were then. Now, there are exceptions to the story I've just told you, and guess who were the exceptions? If you do not know that your Baptist ancestors were the exceptions to this story, you need to know, and you need to be very, very proud. Like, for instance, there is Roger Williams, very well educated, had been at Cambridge, very smart guy, and he decided that he didn't like this idea of the state compelling anybody to do anything. It shouldn't compel you to be a believer. It shouldn't compel you to go to church. It shouldn't compel you to be a member of that church to hold public office, and it most definitely should not compel you to pay taxes to support a church you don't believe in. So, as most of you know, he moved to Rhode Island, or as it was called by the Puritans, Rogues Island, R-U-G-U-E-S, as a symbol of the kind of dissipation that Roger Williams and his heresy represented. And here is what Roger Williams wrote in this migration as a Baptist. He didn't remain a Baptist very long, but he was a Baptist when he wrote this and when he went to Rhode Island. I desire not that liberty to myself, which I would not freely and impartially weigh out to all the consciences of the world besides. All these consciences, yea, the very consciousness of papists, which is what they call Catholics, Jews, Mohammedans, etc., ought freely and impartially to be permitted their several worship, their ministers of worship, and what way of maintaining them they freely chose. So the first plea for Baptist freedom, in fact, religious freedom, in the history of the world so far as I know is Thomas Helwys, our Baptist ancestor in England. And in this country, the first such claim for Baptist for religious freedom was, in fact, Roger Williams. And incidentally, if you think this is not a part of that great Baptist tradition, since he wasn't a Baptist very long, the greatest Baptist theologian of the 19th century was a man named Francis Whalen. Dick, you know the name because Whalen Baptist College out in West Texas is named for him because he moved out to Texas later on. But Francis Whalen was at the time the president of Brown University and an ordained Baptist minister. And 100 years after Roger Williams wrote this, he was asked his impression of religious freedom, and he said, "I don't think I need to add anything to what Roger Williams has already said. He's already said all Baptists need to say. That's it." So this tradition of Baptists saying, we demand the right to freely worship God as we choose, and we demand that the state leave us alone, and furthermore, we extend that right to everyone else, is a really radical step in the history of religious freedom, and it is one reason why some historians say that the American Revolution is actually quite a radical revolution because it extends religious freedom, in theory at least, to everyone, not just to those of us who are the majority. That's really, really an important statement. But though Roger Williams is the name everybody knows, there are a lot of other Baptists on the frontier who, for instance, refused to pay taxes in Massachusetts and are sent to jail. John Leland, Isaac Backus, just to give you two famous Baptist names. And both of them were Baptist ministers, not well-educated, but men of great faith and a stern backbone. And when they were told to cease preaching because of their heresies, they continued to preach and they went to jail and suffered terribly in jail. Not only that, but in Virginia, the Baptists played the major role in disestablishing a state religion, attacking the Anglican Church. And this is essentially a backcountry versus eastern seaboard battle. Anglicans were mainly centered on the eastern seaboard. They had most of the education. They had most of the wealth. They had the support of the British government and the American Revolution, whereas the Baptists were centered in the Piedmont all the way to what is now West Virginia, all the way through to the Ohio River. And they were fierce opponents of a state religion and fierce opponents of paying taxes to support the Anglican Church, which they did not belong to or believe in. So when Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and James Monroe began to argue for the right of religious freedom, their strongest support came not from deists like Jefferson, but came from Baptists. In fact, a wonderful book by, of all things, an Australian historian about Baptists in Virginia argued that Baptists probably played the major role in the rise of religious freedom in Virginia, led by Jefferson, of course. Speaking of Jefferson, there's one other story I want to tell you in the run-up to Auburn First Baptist Church. In 1800, America had what is probably the ugliest, meanest election in our history. And it always amuses me when people talk about the last presidential election being really dirty. Now, if you want a dirty election, go back to 1800 or even Andrew Jackson's election in 1824, where they accused his wife of adultery and in 1800 accused Thomas Jefferson of being an atheist. And it was such a mean election, and there was so much bitterness, and there was so much division in the early American Republic that some people worried about our future. Therefore, a group of Baptists in the Baptist Church in, at Danbury, Connecticut, wrote Thomas Jefferson a letter, and they asked him for a very simple petition. They said, "Mr. President, we supported you for president, as in fact did most poorly educated frontier people and Baptists, and the country is so divided that we would like for you to declare a national day of prayer. And if you declare this national day of prayer, all of us who are Jeffersonians and all of the Federalists who did not support you, supported John Adams, will in fact be united because they'll be praying together." And this is the letter which Jefferson wrote back to his Baptist friends in Danbury. "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legislative powers of government reach actions only but not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state." First time that phrase was ever used in American history. And Jefferson connects it to the idea that the state will not prohibit the free exercise of religion, but it will make no law establishing religion. And if you make a law that says everybody will gather together on a certain day to offer a prayer for the unity of the country, haven't you imposed your religion? Suppose these are atheists. Do they come to your prayer meeting to pray for the unity of the people? So it was in response to a group of Baptists that Thomas Jefferson issued the famous edict that is not in the Constitution, but is certainly in the Supreme Court decisions on school prayer, especially in New York in 1962, written by an Alabama Baptist by the name of Hugo Black, who was a Sunday school teacher for 30 years at Birmingham's First Baptist Church, in which he took this phrase of a wall of separation and said that means the state of New York cannot read a prayer for everybody to read in public schools. So, long Baptist tradition there. Now, one other point here in this story that's very important before we get to the First Baptist story that we are part of is that periodically there are periods of intense revival spirit in America during these years. Part of that is due to the infant mortality rate being spectacularly high. Part of it was due to the uncertainty of knowing whether you were saved or not. And as a consequence of that, there were great revivalists, and the most important of these, and probably the greatest theologian of colonial America, was a man named Jonathan Edwards, who was in fact a Puritan. He was pastor of the First Congregational Church in Northampton, Massachusetts. And in 1835, he launched a revival, and the revival went for 2 years, and hundreds of people were converted. And then in 1850, he started another revival. That went on for 2 years. Thousands of people were converted. And then they fired him as pastor. And they fired him for writing absolutely wonderful books of theology and also for introducing something which is followed in the First Baptist Church of Auburn, Alabama. Because in addition to saying that religion and faith in Christ is a matter of the heart and not just of the mind. It's not cognitive and rational. It is a matter of your emotions as well as your mind. And in addition to that, anyone converted ought to be able to tell the church, stand up before the church and say, "This is my witness. This is my testimony to my conversion." Do you have any idea how few Baptist churches do this and how unique we are in having everyone who is baptized in our church give or have read for them a statement of their conversion experience? Jonathan Edwards said that's essential, and they fired him as pastor of the church. He goes out to the frontier, and he begins to preach a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. He was an angry pastor, and his God was angry. And it was said that when he finished his sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, that hell was so specific that you could find it on a map. And so we have the birth of frontier religion, emotional religion, religion not controlled by education in the mind, but let loose like a wildfire. And the Great Awakening of the 1730s and 40s is one of the great religious revivals in the history of America. Very important story. Where are we, Dale? I got 7 minutes. I'm good. I'm doing just great. Okay, here we are in Alabama. Oh, I know. I can't leave. Sorry about that. I'm used to walking around. Here we are in Alabama, and contrary to all the logic of geographical settlement, Alabama was settled all wrong. This is the westward movement from New England, which is up here, sweeping across the Atlantic seaboard, which is here, going to the Appalachian Mountains, and then when the Indians were cleared from the Appalachian Mountains, sweeping across into Missouri in the west. So they're going like this into what is called the Southwest. That's Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana. That's the Southwest. And they're sweeping like this, except Alabama. Alabama was settled in two different migrations. One is when the Scotch-Irish came to America in the colonial period and they got to the Appalachian Mountains and they couldn't cross because the Indians were there and would scalp them. They came straight down the Appalachian Mountains, the eastern slope of the Appalachians, until they got to the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers, and then they came into Alabama on the Tennessee. So this area around Huntsville, Decatur, Florence, Tuscumbia is very early in settlement, And the early plantations were all up here in this very fertile watershed of the Tennessee River. The other major settlement is down here, and it's ethnic. This was a swath of land reaching from Florida to Louisiana, and it was French, and it was Spanish. Spanish first, then French. And so a lot of these people spoke French, and they spoke Spanish. And from Mobile, they went up the Alabama, the Tom Bigbee River, and they settled this area. For instance, this is the famous vine and olive community at Demopolis up here. And so the lower part of Alabama settled, the upper part of Alabama settled. None of this is settled. This is still Indian territory. Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw Creek. And not until the Indian Wars began is this area settled. And the first part of this is settled after the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, the Treaty of Fort Jackson in December of 1814. And that treaty allows that all the territory west of the Coosa River will now be open to settlement. So are you following me here? If you can't see, you're in trouble. This is the Coosa River. Everything west of the Coosa River, that would be the Black Belt, begins to be settled after 1814. But guess what is still under the control of the Creeks? Everything east of the Coosa River, that means Auburn. So we are still under Indian control, Creek control, until the Second Creek War of 1834-1836. And so not until the Creeks are removed and sent on the Trail of Tears to Arkansas, many probably anywhere from a fourth to a third of them died on the way, never made it that far. But that's when this land that we now sit on, stand on, was settled. So when you think about Auburn First Baptist being founded in 1838, and they're, I mean, the First Baptist Church was founded in Huntsville, actually Flint River. That's my church. And it was founded in 1808, and you're thinking, well, what happened? Are we slow down here to be Baptist? Well, no. This was Indian territory, and not until John Harper came over from Georgia and bought the land from the Creek Indians and said, well, I'm going to start this town, and this young, beautiful girl he met said, oh, I know what you ought to call it because I've just been reading some poetry and you all called it Auburn. And by George, that's Auburn. And John Harper decided, because he was a Methodist layman and because he was a teetotaler and a man who believed in temperance, he believed that if you gave land to churches, it would be filled up with church people and they would all vote against serving alcohol and you would have an alcohol-free town. So he gave a lot to the Presbyterians. Boy, did he miss there. And then he gave a lot to the Methodists, and they're sort of shaky on this. But of course, when he founded the Baptist Church, that's what made this temperate city. I'm just joking. But he wasn't joking. He really wanted this to be a temperance place. And incidentally, so did the first pastor of First Baptist Church, Obadiah Holmes. Now, in order to tell you about Obadiah Holmes, other than the fact that he was first pastor on June 19th, 1838, it's important for you to understand that the churches were not like they are now. For instance, the vast majority of Alabamians were not God-fearing people. They were hell-raising good old boys. And if you read the literature from the period, what you will get is comments like this. This is a early Anglican pastor in Mobile. The soldiers and villagers of this town are strangers to virtue and familiars of dissipation and debauchery. The Reverend Samuel Hart, who was sent by the Episcopal Church to pastor a church there in 1764, stayed there 1 year and then gave up and went back to Virginia, saying the place was so spiritually sterile and the atmosphere so uncongenial, no godly person could live there. Or this is the territorial capital of St. Stephen's in 1817, where Lorenzo Dow, the famous Methodist jackleg preacher, showed up preaching like Jonathan Edwards, hell, fire, and damnation. And they said, you know, really, you're going to have to cool it, Lorenzo. We don't like that. We're happy. We're very content, and we are tired of this hellfire and damnation stuff. And so he preached another hellfire and damnation sermon, and they put him adrift in a canoe to Mobile. And as he went around the bend on which St. Stephen's sits, he, according to one person, raised his fist and said, "St. Stephen's, be damned. I came to you and you received me not. I confine this den of iniquity to the snakes, bats, and owls." Parenthetically, footnote, the next month, the Alabama Territorial Legislature changed the capital from St. Stephen's to Cahaba, and St. Stephen's very slowly died. And if you go there now, there's nothing left but crepe myrtles and garden figs under the oak trees they planted. There are no people who live in St. Stephen's. To my knowledge, this is the only Alabama town ever consigned to perdition for rejecting salvation. But it may be there are others, and I just don't know about them. But incidentally, in my Alabama Baptist book, I talk about J.H. Haggard making a tour in April of 1846, and he wrote of his 4 days travel in the Alabama Baptist, "I visited 34 or 35 families. 23 were completely destitute. In more than a third, there was no professing Christian. In many families, no one could read at all. One day I visited 8 families, only 2 of which had a Bible. In 5 families, only 1 person could read. 12 persons over age 12 of these 5 families could not read. None of the 5 had a book of any kind. One family of a man and his wife in their 60s and 70s had a marriage son and another son of about 18. None had ever owned a Bible. The old man could not read. He had been a drunkard, though he was now sober. His wife was a pious member of the Baptist church but could not read the Bible, though she could read some of the familiar songs in the hymnal, Dale. The preacher had quit their church because of the lack of interest among the members, and now they had no services at all." And incidentally, this is fairly common. Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterians, they all write the same thing. "Therefore, in the 1820s and 30s, there were a whole series of revivals." This is called the Second Great Awakening. It began at Cane Creek Church in Kentucky in 1801, swept through the southern frontier like a wildfire. Lots of Baptist churches would baptize, if you can believe this, 500 people in a week, 300 people in a week. And partly it was because of things like the cemetery behind Hatchet Creek Presbyterian Church, where my wife's people are buried, and I walked through it one time. We were there for the reunion. M.Y. and J.P. Sewell, 2 infant sons, John Manley, born on September 1st, 1884, died October 21st, 1886. Unnamed son, born and died April 9th, 1887, born and died the same day. G.J. and E.L. Berry lost 2 daughters, both aged 2. I.W. and M.E. Jones buried 3 children there, 2 daughters ages 17 and 20, and a son, 22. I mean, you know, it's not hard to have a revival. All you have to say, do you want reunion with your children? And it's pretty easy to have a revival. And so the revival swept through the South and through Alabama. And the 2 groups that profited most from this were the groups that did not require any education requirements, that did not require anything but a sense of a call of God. They were almost always bivocational, like the pastors of Auburn First Baptist Church, which means they earned their income somewhere else. And they're always very much like the people to whom they preached. They were not separated by education, by background. They were one of the people. And so the Anglicans had problems because they had educational requirements and they were too wealthy and they were too liturgical and they worshiped the altar more than they worshiped the sermon, whereas the Methodist and the Baptist preach hellfire, damnation, and salvation and repentance and grace. And as a result, the pulpit was the center of what they did, and they preached just like the people taught. And so it was not surprising that Obadiah Holmes, the first pastor of Auburn Baptist Church, was from a little county in Georgia. He had no formal education. He came into a church that had, there was no church from 1838 until 1843, there was no church at all. 5 years, they worshiped in houses, homes, because there was no church. When they built a church, they built it out of logs, and the floor was dirt. And there were 2 entrances, one for the women and children and one for the men, because they never sat together. It was racially integrated from the beginning. The slaves sat, when it was real small, they sat in the back, and when there was a balcony, they sat in the balcony. But spatially, blacks and whites worshiped together until the end of the Civil War, which is really funny, isn't it? We fought like everything in the civil rights movement over blacks wanting to come to our churches when blacks had been in our churches all along. And incidentally, some of the best preachers were, in fact, people like Caesar Blackwell, a slave who was freed by the Alabama Association and became a spellbinding preacher and one of the most popular revivalists among Baptists in the state. However, you would find that getting to one of those churches, like Auburn First Baptist, was a real problem. Because of the 23 churches in the Alabama Association, the largest association, that's Montgomery, Lowndes County, and all central Alabama, there were two churches in that entire association that held services every Sunday. One of them was First Baptist Montgomery, the most important, powerful, and affluent church in the state. Other than that, every church met once a month, like Auburn First Baptist. And not only did they only meet once a month, but they only met once a month when it wasn't too cold and the roads, the dirt roads, were passable instead of quagmires of mud, so you could come. So realistically, if you went to church every single Sunday when the church met during the year, you might go six times a year. Maybe at the most seven or eight times a year. Very seldom, 12 times a year, think January, and a mud road. And as a result of that, you got your religion in camp meeting revivals after lay-by time in August and September. That's when you were saved. And there was almost never a profession of faith in a Baptist church on a Sunday morning at a regular service. It was the spellbinding preachers, sometimes Baptist, sometimes Methodist, sometimes Presbyterian, but all of them praying for your soul and bringing you to the Savior. That is what Auburn First Baptist Church was like when we began with Obadiah Holmes, a very ordinary man, very little education. And I think one of the greatest lines that I have ever read of a Baptist preacher is the one John Jeffers quotes about Obadiah Holmes at the end of his life. This is from the Alabama Baptist. Talk about praising with, well, I'll just let you hear it. This is from the Alabama Baptist, November 2nd. Let me make sure I got the right one here. Yeah, here it is. As a preacher, he belonged to the old style without much method, but earnest, always entertaining, always quaint, and at times somewhat tedious. In his method of speaking, he was deliberate, occasionally quite emotional, and but for a habit of taking after a side thought at times, would have been very effective. Indeed, he was quite useful whenever his mind became deeply interested in his subject and when engaged in revival meetings. The churches he served in the days of his manhood enjoyed a fair degree of prosperity. That's what you call faint praise. But that is the history of Auburn First Baptist Church. And incidentally, I might say that, like many historians do, Mary Fraser's history actually lists the first pastor as G.P. Thomas from Georgia. And John's history follows Hosea Holcomb, the first Baptist historian in 1850, who said that Obadiah Holmes was the first pastor. And I've always wondered what John would do if Miss Fraser had been alive when he wrote this, because since she was dead, he could say, well, it was Obadiah Holmes who was the first pastor. But I wondered if he would have had the guts to do that if one of his most important matriarchs in the church, Mary Fraser, had still been alive and she had said G.P. Thomas was the first pastor. Okay, next week, we're gonna take you to the Civil War and you'll learn some things about culture and Baptists.